This week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about how dark skin can be deadly when the tech is biased. And we bring you Jonathan Heiliger of Vertex Ventures. Twyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 512, recorded September 23rd, 2022. Smart money makes the world go round.
This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla. IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. Hosted by Bridget Todd, this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Search for IRL in your podcast player. And by Jinx Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee. Go to canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How to Hear About Us box.
Welcome to Twyatt, your weekly source for everything that matters in the world of enterprise technology. I'm Kurt Franklin, and I'm your host for this episode of Twyatt. It is, as usual, going to be a great show. We've got a fabulous guest, some interesting things to talk about before we get there. And before I do anything else, it's time to say hello to my co-host for this episode of Twyatt, Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, how are things on your end of the neighborhood?
I'm doing fine. You know, we're obviously watching the weather reports and seeing how things are going. It doesn't look like it's going to be horrible, but never hurts to be prepared. I am, however, tinkering a little bit with a technology. If you've been looking at the fiber to the home or fiber from the curb, this actually exists on a single strand of fiber, and it's called a GPON. And what it does is it allows you, a service provider like AT&T or whoever, to be able to go and string up to 128 homes off a single strand of fiber. And depending on how strong that optics are, you know, doing a 10-kilometer, 40-kilometer, or even 100-kilometer strand of fiber is well within the realm of reality. So hopefully, as things like that unit, that was like a under $20 unit, as those things start dropping in price, hopefully internet service providers will be able to go and do more interesting things. So lots of fun. Hopefully I'll be using some of those at the Orlando Maker Fair on November 5th and 6th.
I don't know. I'm having all kinds of pictures of great campus-wide deployments, and going over a big campus with stuff like that looks cool. Well, we have, as I said, a great show, and it's time to dive into it. Let's start with the blips. You know, we spend a lot of time here on Twyatt talking about the extent to which disgruntled or careless employees are a security risk for enterprises large and small. I suppose on some level it's comforting to know that the same employee risk exists for the bad guys too. According to an article on Dark Reading, a developer for the Lockbit ransomware as a service operation publicly released the encryptor code for the latest version of the malware, Lockbit 3.0, also known as Lockbit Black, to GitHub. There was apparently some job dissatisfaction at work here. Now, the bad news is that other ransomware operators, including some that are just wannabes, now have access to the builder for what is arguably one of the most sophisticated and dangerous ransomware strains currently on the market. The good news is that security researchers now have a chance to take apart the builder software and better understand the threat. Now, Lockbit's operators have tried to present themselves as a professional outfit focused mainly on targets in the professional services, retail, manufacturing, and wholesale sectors. The group has promised on their honor not to attack healthcare entities, educational and charitable institutions. But since they are, in fact, criminals, security researchers have observed groups using the ransomware attacking the off-limit targets anyway. Now, LockBit surfaced in 2019 and has since emerged as one of the biggest current ransomware threats. In the first half of 2022, researchers from Trend Micro identified some 1,843 attacks involving LockBit, making it the most used ransomware strain the company has encountered this year. In a similar vein, a report from Palo Alto Networks Unit 42 threat research team described the previous version of the ransomware, that's LockBit 2.0, as accounting for 46% of all ransomware breach events in the first 5 months of this year. Now, while there is undoubtedly value for researchers in seeing this code, the ultimate advantage it brings may be small. Following the leak, LockBit's authors are likely hard at work rewriting the builder to ensure that future versions won't be compromised in the same way.
All right, so this article, which comes to us from the folks at Ars Technica, got kind of kicked into high gear because of the pandemic. Now, for years, the studies have found some racial bias in a common oxygen measuring device called pulse oximeters, as well as alarming dangers for inaccurate blood oxygen measurements in dark-skinned patients. See, dark skin. Now, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is summoning its expert advisors to review the problematic devices and consider new recommendations and regulatory actions. The FDA announced last Thursday that its advisory committee, called the Anesthesiology and Respiratory Therapy Devices Panel, ARTDP, will convene on November 1st to discuss pulse oximeters. Until then, the agency renewed emphasis on the safety warning it issued in February 2021, which noted that the ubiquitous devices, quote, may be less accurate in people with dark skin pigmentation. And the warning actually closely followed a study from December 2020 that highlighted the same. Well, this is certainly a story that makes me go, since I'm more than a little tan and since I suffer from COPD and use a pulse oximeter daily, I'm now wondering if perhaps my COPD diagnosis is skewed because of the bias in this instrument.
Well, according to a report by Anaconda, a data science platform firm, in the last past year, 40% of surveyed data scientists, business analysts, and students have scaled back their use of open source components since vulnerabilities in open source components, like the widespread flaws revealed 10 months ago in Log4j 2.0, have forced them to reevaluate the code frequently used in analysis and the creation of machine learning models. An article at Dark Reading points out that concerns over the security in open source software is a relatively new trend for the data science world. The security of open source components and the software supply chain in general has become a primary consideration among software developers, businesses, and national governments over the last 2 years. In May, for example, NIST issued guidance to address software supply chain risks. And a growing number of software vendors have joined with the Linux Foundation's Open Software Security Foundation, or OpenSSF. In general, software companies are not seeing any sort of decrease in open source usage overall, focusing instead on improving the security of the open source software and using security as a primary guide in selecting their components. One major issue, though, is that companies have relatively few alternatives when moving away from one open source package than to adopt a different package whose maintainers, they believe, have put a greater emphasis on security. Now, how can developers really tell where that maintainer emphasis lies? Maintainers of the most critical projects, of which there are hundreds, if not thousands, need to use secure dependencies, test their own code, and validate the trustworthiness of contributors. The maintainers should also be publishing a security scorecard. A Google-created initiative now managed by OpenSSF gives a security grade to a project based on nearly 20 different criteria. Well, according to our criteria, that's it for the blips, and it's time to the bite. But before we get there, we need to hear from Lou Maresca.
Well, thank you, guys. I'll get you back to your enterprise and IT news in just one moment. But before we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla. IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. Hosted by Bridget Todd, this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Who can AI help? Who can it harm? The show features fascinating conversations with people who are working to build more trustworthy AI. For example, there's an episode about how our world is mapped with AI. The data that's missing from those maps tells as much of a story as the maps themselves. Now, you'll hear all about the people who are working to fill in those gaps and take control of the data. Now, there's another episode about gig workers who depend on apps for their livelihood. It looks at how they're pushing back against algorithms that control how much they get paid and seeking new ways to gain power over data to create better working conditions. For political junkies, there are episodes about the role that AI plays when it comes to the spread of misinformation and hate speech around elections, a huge concern for democracies around the world. Now, I really like season 4, episode 1, checking out online shopping. There, they talk about the hidden costs of shopping online and off. What are you giving up? Meta Brown, a data scientist from Amazon, is on the show and talks about what happens when you make an online purchase. It just may actually shock you. Super compelling episode. Definitely check it out. Search for IRL in your podcast player. We'll also include a link in today's show notes. And we thank IRL for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Back to you guys.
Thanks, Lou. We appreciate that. And don't worry, we'll be hearing more from Lou later on in the show. But now it's time for our bite, our slightly longer and more detailed look at one of the stories that's been in the news this week. On Tuesday, Microsoft released a big, thick PDF detailing Windows 11's new security-focused features. Among the big things they were talking about was zero trust. Now, zero trust is a topic we have looked at extensively here on TWiET. Some of that is because it's so darn important, and some of that is because for a few years, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, and many others have been working with the U.S. government to improve cybersecurity using zero trust as one of the principal techniques. It's no coincidence that the three big cloud service providers are looking at this because they are very well positioned to institute controls to prevent truly catastrophic cyber attacks. Microsoft, though, is doing something a little bit different because they're moving security down the stack, all the way down the stack into firmware. Now, there have been flaws in firmware that we've talked about before. Firmware for CPUs, printers, storage area networks, network attached storage, all kinds of external devices provide locations where vulnerabilities can hide and attackers can gain access to a network. Now, according to Microsoft, these sorts of threats call for computing hardware that's secure down to the very core, including hardware and processors which store sensitive business information. They say that with hardware-based protection, we can enable strong mitigation against entire classes of vulnerabilities that are difficult to thwart with software alone. So, what are we talking about when it comes to Microsoft? The phrase is hardware root of trust. In simple English, that means a starting point that is implicitly trusted. If you're talking about a PC, it's a component that checks the BIOS code to make sure that it's legitimate before it boots the machine. Now, anyone who's gone in and had to pull malware off a machine that has a malware compromise knows just how important this is, because it's difficult to go in and mitigate things in the BIOS if the developer of that malware is any good at all. Now, there are new security measures, including storing sensitive data like crypto keys and user credentials, completely isolated from the operating system inside their own sort of software strongbox. Microsoft requires a TPM, or Trusted Platform Module 2.0, chip to be installed on Windows 11 machines that are new or upgraded. The company had required TPM 2.0 capabilities on their Windows 10 machines, but the latest version of Windows won't even run if the computer doesn't have that chip. Now, Windows 11 machines all now include the Microsoft Pluton security processor in the system on a chip that has replaced the classic CPU on the motherboard. Pluton's not new. It's been around for a couple of years, but it eliminates an attack vector. Now, not all Windows 11 machines will have this chip, but all absolutely positively will have a TPM 2.0 chip. Now, Brian, I want to bring you in because TPM chips have been around for a while. These aren't new. And there are still a lot of concerns about how to properly set them up, including some warning that if you do it incorrectly, if you do it badly enough, you brick the system. So what do you think? Is it that hard? Is it that sensitive? And is there some sort of key to getting it right?
Well, I think a lot of any kind of hardware-based security system is, you got to read the instructions. The days of being able to just wing it, you know, just stop. Just read the instructions first. That was one of the biggest problems I saw when people first started having to deal with UEFI and then TPM version 1. It was frustrating because there was so much FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt going around. And the day people would go in and just, oh, I can set this up, I'm an expert, and paint themselves into a corner. You're also going to need to make sure you start making sure you have a password vault or something to make sure that you don't lose those passwords. Now, my biggest question I had when TPM first started coming out was, how am I going to handle a TPM requirement on a virtualized server? You know, especially if I start doing VDI, virtual desktop infrastructure, and I want to use Windows 10. When Windows 10 first came out and they were saying, oh, you must have TPM, it's like, how am I going to do that on a Blade server or a virtualized environment when I only have one TPM chip? It kind of got solved. Now, in this massive tome of a PDF, they address this. Because Windows 11 is going to be a very key portion of VDI in the Microsoft world, they started going into a silicon-assisted security measures using virtualization-based security. So look for the new acronym, VBS. Quote, the isolated VBS environment protects processes such as security solutions and credential managers from other processes running in memory. According to this PDF, even if malware gains access to the main OS kernel, the hypervisor and virtualization hardware will help prevent the malware from executing unauthorized code or accessing platform secrets in the VBS environment. Sounds good to me. So there's a lot of things that are happening. And if you say why, it's because we've, as an industry, have been complaining very, very loudly that we want zero trust. We want to be able to not get hit by all this malware. We want to be able to trust our computing environments. We want to be able to basically get on with doing business. And this is one of those things that you're going to have to take your spoonful of medicine. TPM, the virtual environment, the VBS and so forth, you're going to need to do something, because if someone, if malware is going to get in and they go in, let's say, for instance, we get hit by one of those wonderful malwares that can get in, say like Moonbounce or TrickBot or LoJax, that actually worms its way into the low-level code. What I keep hearing is, well, the only reliable way of fixing this is to actually throw away the machine, which doesn't make anyone feel good about this. So for us to be able to keep moving forward with the cloud, the world of clouds, the world of hybrid environments, the world of, you know, massive computing, we need to be able to trust the platforms. And so, sorry, folks, TPM is going to be something we're going to have to deal with. We're going to have to deal with, you know, have the dynamic root trust of and things like that. And we're going to have to start learning how to do this. So Windows 11 is that bitter medicine we're going to have to take and get used to, if we want to do it. Unfortunately, I've got some reasonably old machines, so I've got a sneaky hunch I'm going to have to save up my shekels to buy myself a new machine that does have TPM 2.0. And if that's going to happen, I'm probably going to try and see if I can get one that supports Pluton so that I have a little bit more future that I can count on. And now then maybe I'll start going and do some interesting things with Windows 11. Ought to be interesting. But from a security world, we want zero trust. Here's one of the foundation blocks.
Well, Brian, let me ask this. We say we want zero trust. We know that we've heard that. We know that this is a step in the right direction. But should we also temper expectations? Will having this chip mean that forevermore we don't have to worry about any other part of security? Or is this a critical part, but not a silver bullet?
Yeah, I think the latter. It is a foundation stone. I'm not sure I'd call it a keystone, but it is definitely an important foundation stone. You can't expect the ability to have a trusted computing environment if the foundation stones are weak. I guess that's the best analogy I can come up with. We need to be able to trust. Just because, you know, say, for instance, the used computing environment, that market, you know, we actually had Curvature on the show not too terribly long ago, and they make their living refurbishing and selling, you know, computing devices and network devices. Well, if we can't trust them, gee, what are we going to do? Does that mean we can no longer have used equipment? That doesn't sound like a really good solution. So I'm hoping this foundation stone will allow us to be able to start trusting. It just means that, you know, like a used car, you want to make sure you have the correct keys, you know, both, you know, if you have an old car, you need the key to the trunk and the key to the doors. In the used computing environment, you're just going to have to make sure that the TPM chips are reset and that the passwords are turned over to you. So things to learn, things to change, the world's going to change. Foundation stones. I, you know, that's actually a good title for the show, foundation stones.
I like the idea of the foundation. I have looked at what is required to properly implement this, and you're right. Read the instructions. It has details to the process, but it's not something that requires either an advanced degree in physics or Olympic level acrobatic skills in order to properly deploy. Just, you know, walk down the list, do it right, and make sure you're not being either hasty or stupid in setting things up, and all should be well. You know, this is the sort of thing, zero trust is going to be the architecture that we lean on for a long time. It just makes too much sense. And so I suspect this is not the last time we've heard about this. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't hear about other operating systems making the same sort of requirements of hardware vendors in the very, very near future. Well, speaking of the near future, in our near future, we have a wonderful guest coming on. We're through with the blips. We're through with the bites. It's almost time for the guest. But before we can talk to our guest, we need to hear from Lou Maresca one more time.
Well, thank you, guys. I'll get you back to your enterprise and IT news in just one moment. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Thinks Canary. Now, if there's anything we've learned from this last year, it's that companies must make it a priority to layer the security of their networks. We talk about it all the time. Now, one of those layers needs to be Thinks Canary. Unfortunately, companies usually find out too late they've been compromised, even after they've already spent millions of dollars on IT security. Now, attackers are really sneaky. Unbeknownst to companies, they prowl your networks looking for valuable data. But the great thing about Canary is they've turned this into an advantage for you. Now, while attackers browse Active Directory for file servers and explore file shares, they'll be looking for documents. They'll try default passwords against network devices and web services. They will scan for open services across the network. Now, Thinks Canaries are designed to look like the things that hackers want to get to. Canaries can be deployed throughout your entire network, and you can make them look identical to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server, so attackers won't know they've been caught. You can put fake files on them and name them in ways that get the hackers' attention, and you can enroll them in Active Directory. When attackers investigate further, they give themselves away, and you're instantly notified. Canary tokens act as tiny tripwires that you can drop into hundreds of places. Canary is designed to be installed and configured in minutes, and you won't have to think about them again. If an alert happens, Canary will notify you any way you want, and you won't be inundated with false alarms. Get alerts by email or text message, right on your console there through Slack, webhooks, syslog, or even their API. Now, data breaches happen typically through your staff. And when they do, companies often don't know they've been compromised. It takes an average of 191 days for a company to realize there's been a data breach. Canary solves that problem. Canary was created by people who have trained companies, militaries, and governments on how to break into networks. And with that knowledge, they built Canary. You'll find Canaries deployed all over the world and are one of the best tools against data breaches. Visit canary.tools/twit for just $7,500 per year. You'll get 5 Canaries, your own hosted console, upgrade, support, and maintenance. And if you use code TWIT in the How to Hear About Us box, you'll get 10% off the price for life. We know you'll love your Thinks Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your Canaries with their 2-month money back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How to Hear About Us box. And we thank Thinks Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Back to you guys.
Thanks, Lou. We appreciate you taking care of business for us. Now, it's time for our guest, and before we bring him on, got to say that in the technology industries, in IT and security and networking, all of these, it doesn't matter how good your idea is. If you don't have enough money to develop it, market it, sell it, introduce it to the market and build a market around it, it will never see the light of day. And in the IT world, that initial money more often than not comes from a venture capital firm. As important as these firms are to the industry, we haven't had a chance to talk to venture capitalists very much here on This Week in Enterprise Technology. So this week, we're pleased to be able to have as our guest Jonathan Heiliger, general partner at Vertex Ventures US. Jonathan, welcome to TWIET.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We are pleased to have you because we have a whole bunch of questions that we want to ask. And the first one is about you. With all the misunderstanding and lack of understanding that many people have about venture capital, it's got to start with being a venture capitalist. How does one become a venture capitalist, or more particularly, how did you become a venture capitalist?
I think there's lots of paths into venture capital, which is the good and the bad thing. First off, like I said, thanks for having me. We started Vertex US about 7 years ago. We're an early stage venture capital firm that backs enterprising founders, if you like the play on words there. And all five of us on the investment team are all former founders and operators, and spend all of our time, investing and helping founders hopefully be more successful with their business. But to answer your question, how did I get my start? I got my start in tech when I was 17. I almost dropped out of high school. I fell in love with this thing called the NSFNet and worked at Stanford on commercializing it, turning it into the internet. And at 19, I co-founded and was CTO of a web hosting company, one of the first web hosting providers, and was very fortunate that that company was ultimately acquired by bigger and bigger fish and set me on my path for my love of infrastructure and building and helping scale engineering teams. And got to do that for 20-something years before making the change to venture capital. And so my move to venture capital was as a result of helping people all along the way who had either helped me or who were building and solving interesting problems in tech. And I just wanted to help them and give them some time and some feedback or connect them with somebody who might be a buyer for their products. And ultimately that's the short story of what led me to venture.
Outstanding. Well, now I've got to ask, a lot of people, the closest thing they will come to seeing venture capital at work is watching a show like Shark Tank. Is that for you anything like a realistic representation of the way you get pitches and the process by which you say, I've heard your pitch, we'll give you this much for that much of the company? Or is the process that you work through radically different from that?
I think just like everything on TV and in the movies documentary movies, there's shreds of truth there, and there's shreds of truth with Shark Tank and in the world we live in of or how we practice venture capital. But for the last 10 plus years, it's really been a very founder-centric market, and the adage is that good founders can raise in any market. But I think that adage extends to, especially for the last decade, that people have been able to raise capital fairly easily and quickly, just with sort of pitching an idea on Hacker News and letting people come to them, or checking in some code into GitHub, and maybe it's an open source project, and then that gets some traction and that pops up on an investor's radar. And so, candidly, Curtis, a lot of what we do is outbound, very thematic research. We spend about 60% of our time and capital in software infrastructure, which you could, think of as, tools and technology to build other things, whether that's in the cloud or developer tools or data infrastructure. And then the other, 40% or so of the time and capital we invest at Vertex, we're picking different vertical software markets to research, to build communities, to build our own sort of book of knowledge in, and then find entrepreneurs to invest in. So yeah, we get we get pitched 700-800 times a year, and we make about five investments a year, and that's really a combination of People who find us through our network or through our website or through an accelerator like a Y Combinator or Alchemist Accelerator, get some training, get some coaching, or us reaching outbound because we hear about a cool new open source project or founder that's building a, you know, an interesting piece of technology in an area that we've been studying.
You know, I think it's very instructive, that difference between the 700 to 800 companies that present to you, that you know about and are pitched to you, and the 5 to 10 that you actually invest in every year. That's a rejection rate that the Ivy League schools would kill for. So let me ask.
Knock on Ivy League.
When you look back at those five to 10 companies, those few companies every year, is there a common thread that links the companies that tend to be something that you want to work with? I'm going to guess with the disparity between the number of companies that pitch you and the number you support, it's not enough just to have a good idea for a product.
Absolutely right. The idea is actually, you know, is pretty easy. It's maybe how you got there that gets harder. So we find that we tend to back two types of personalities, or even people that have both of these traits in common. The first is that they're practitioners. They have some empathy because they've, you know, maybe worked inside of another company before, or they, you know, toiling away in a research lab on a problem for a long period of time. And, you know, they ran into issues. They ran into gates or problems or some frustration that they wanted a piece of technology to solve. And they got so frustrated that they built that technology themselves, and they decided to, you know, build a business based on having experienced that problem and being frustrated about it. And then the second personality trait that we've found in common with the founders we invest in really is people who are who are infectious leaders, people who can who are magnets maybe for talent, where you sit down with them and you get excited about the idea and the vision and the business, and it's that combination of two things of, you know, people who are community builders, who are curious and open minded, but also opinionated. Combined with the practitioner's empathy that we have found is most represented across our portfolio. And today today we work with about 40 companies, having made 50 investments total in the last 7 years. So, like I said, pretty concentrated. And the good thing about venture capital is that there's people who make 100 investments a year, and then there's people like us that make 5 investments a year.
Well, once you have made that investment, once you've said, okay, we want to back this company, and it sounds like you really are investing, at the seed level, typically, and here, you know, we'll get into a little bit of insider baseball for companies, for people who don't follow investment. There are a number of different stages of investment, starting with the seed, the founders, then the seed, then you go through a couple of things, going to mezzanine, and then you start getting into the series A, B, C, D, Q, L, P, you know, ultimately ending up with one of two goals of either going public or being bought by somebody like Oracle. You know, those are the two outcomes. So, like I said, I'm guessing that you come in very early in the process rather than being one of the big, you know, Series D investors where hundreds of millions of dollars is often involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Great point. So, yeah, seed rounds are a relatively new phenomenon in venture. I forget exactly when it was, the term was coined, probably around 2005, 2006, I want to say, maybe a little bit earlier. Fundamentally to represent, you know, a small, modest amount of money to really prove out an idea or prove out a thesis. When I started my first company when I was 19, our first round was a Series A, and that was just, it was $5 million and, you know, we were off and running. And for a long period of time leading up to last year, seed rounds grew to be $20, $30 million, just to sort of put it in perspectives. And to put it in perspective, though, that's changed pretty rapidly in 2022. So where we invest at Vertex US is, you know, we invest super early at pre-seed or seed, maybe a $500K to $1 million check. And then we invest at the other side of our barbell, which is a $8 to $10 million investment. Important to note here, also initial investment, Curtis, because there are funds who will invest once and then be done. Sometimes that's like a mezzanine investor, to your point, which is typically the last round before a company goes public. But also along the way, there are funds who will say, hey, I'll give you your first money and then I won't invest again. We are the type of fund that is kind of a classic venture capital model where we reserve capital to continue investing in and working with the founders, working with the team. It's often called, you know, investing your pro rata in the company. So today, our largest positions are $50, $60 million because we've been investing with the company for several years, even though our funds are relatively small for that those position sizes. So the fund that we just closed at the beginning of this month is our third fund. It was a $200 million fund. And we'll make, you know, 20-ish initial investments in that fund. And then as those companies, the third outcome, unfortunately, so the first choice outcome is we build a big company, go public. Second choice outcome is we merge or sell our business with another business. And that, by the way, that happens about 70% of the time in enterprise. And the third outcome is, unfortunately, we have to wind the company down because we didn't get to either of the first two outcomes. So anyway, we will start out with 20-ish initial investments with the idea being that, you know, we'll learn along the way of which ones are performing the best and have the best chances for the first two outcomes and double down on those.
Well, the idea of continuing to invest, I think, is fascinating. And you're right. It does distinguish you from many of the venture companies out there. Now, one of the things that I want to go back to what the movies tell us about venture funds and how they work with companies. And it tends to be one of two things. Either someone comes in and gives a company money and says, call us when you're ready to pay us back. And, you know, maybe additional investments, in which case call us when you're ready to pay back more. The other, and this is probably more common with movies and television, is that the venture capitalists come in, invest money, and then immediately take over and marginalize the founders. The founders are squeezed out. Everyone's unhappy. It's just terrible, terrible, terrible. So I assume that the truth lies somewhere between those two. Can you give me an idea of what reality looks like, at least from the Vertex perspective?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't have stats off the top of my head, so I won't quote numbers for you. But I would say that in my view and in our experience across our portfolio and our past experiences working at you know, very well-known firms, Accel Partners, Menlo Ventures and Sequoia Capital, Crane Ventures, where different folks on our team have come from, it is a failure state that a venture investor has to jump into a company the moment they invest. That is a failure state. We are backing teams and want to see those teams and those people grow and develop over time. But I do think it's an important note that not every person is good at every stage of a company. I learned about myself that I was really good at starting things, and I was really good at, you know, tens of employees to hundreds of employees. When the companies that I was working at got to thousands of employees, I wasn't as good. I wasn't as effective. I wasn't as happy. My performance ratings dropped. You know, I started flunking out, et cetera. And, you know, so that's how I figured out what stage of company I was good at. And so we do spend a lot of time with our portfolio companies helping them build teams and recruit, because we're generally backing these personality types I mentioned, the sort of practitioner and the visionary. These are most oftentimes people with technical backgrounds who don't have deep experience selling products, for example. And so one of the first things we do is help them hire their first go-to-market team and go-to-market leaders, which could be individual sales reps. They could be marketers to do demand gen or some other kind of product-led growth. or enterprise marketing. And our job there is to show what good looks like. Hey, we've done this 100 times. We know that these are the right attributes given the stage and market you're going after. But ultimately, it's the founder's decision on who to hire. We don't tell them who to hire. We make suggestions on who to hire, and we tell them what attributes to look for. Does that answer your question?
I think it does, and it's an important thing. It's interesting that you mentioned the being good at a different part of the company's growth. I know that there are some classic inflection points in the growth of a company that people look for. And I always thought that one of the most impressive things that Michael Dell ever did was when he hired a CEO, because he realized that managing a company the size that Dell had become was out of his wheelhouse. I think it would be good if more founders were able to do that. Well, I want to bring, please.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think that it's a really important realization that, like you said, that he had, and it does happen, you know, quite often. I had the pleasure of working for Mark Zuckerberg for 5 years as Facebook grew from that hundreds of employees to tens of that to about, not quite 10,000 people. But along the way, he hired Sheryl Sandberg as a chief operating officer because he saw in himself his own limitations, of a leader. Or Larry Page and Sergey Brin brought in Eric Schmidt early on to be CEO, you know, of the company, because being CEO or any other C-level job generally means different things. The one than founders are doing at the very beginning, taking the big risk, the big leap, working with customers and building the product. It means you got to be willing to do a 5-hour budget meeting and, you know, come up with a financial plan and arbitrate between what's happening in marketing and sales and finance and all of these other things.
It is an interesting thing, and it's good, as Clint Eastwood says, a man's got to know his limitations. And I would say we can broaden that to simply say a founder's got to know their limitations.
Yeah,
well, I know that one of the things that you have to do as you're looking to invest is understand where the market in general is going so that you have an idea of whether the team and the products that you're looking at have a reasonable chance of succeeding in the market that's going to exist in a couple of years or in 4 years. And I want to bring in my co-host, Brian Chi, to ask some of the questions about how you look at that aspect of what you do.
Now, we've actually had a fairly U.S.-centric conversation so far. And I'd like, you to kind of step back and is the VC market or even technology in your mind different in the U.S. versus, say, the UK, EU, or Asia? Is enterprise technology all in the U.S.? I hope not, but are the good ideas outside of the U.S. also?
Absolutely, yeah. There are a lot of great ideas coming from outside the U.S. So Vertex is a network of funds. We have cousins or relatives, if you will, that focus specifically on investing in China, in Southeast Asia, in India, and in Israel. And so we cover the U.S. and Europe. And so, my view tends to be more U.S.-centric just because that's where I spend, the bulk of my brain power. But there's innovation happening everywhere. And in particular, in SaaS and enterprise software, we do see and hear about a lot of companies starting in India, not just to service the Indian enterprise market, but to serve globally, to serve businesses globally. In our case of our portfolio, for example, in Fund 2, which was 18 companies, 40% of those companies, so just under half, called 8 of 18, started outside the U.S. by the founder started the company outside the U.S. and then emigrated to the U.S. to build and scale the company. And what has generally happened in those situations is the technical team, the engineering team, that nexus, if you will, that's somewhere else. That might be in Israel, it might be in Switzerland or Portugal or the Ukraine. And then the founders have emigrated to the U.S. and they're building the go-to-market team here because, quite frankly, that, in the case of enterprise software, is the real special sauce of Silicon Valley in particular, even within the US, I think. I think if you were starting a bike sharing or scooter sharing company to service Germany or service the UK, you should absolutely start that company there, raise capital there, and be local, really understand the market. But if you're starting a B2B software company, or an open source business that's servicing developers, again, that idea can happen anywhere. The development of that can happen anywhere. But by the time you start selling that software, the real expertise for that is today still concentrated in the US.
Well, let's go and ask a little bit more about the international world. GDPR and other governmental speed bumps have made life a little interesting. How big a speed bump has it been for the VC world?
Honestly, GDPR, I think, has been it's been a boon for the VC world because there's been all kinds of new companies that have gotten created around helping existing businesses manage their data both into and out of the EU, and then in with California, with CCPA, dealing with all of these compliance, new regulations and new types of compliance regimes.
Very cool. Well, one more big question.
Sure.
There's a lot. Everybody thinks they have a great idea, but they don't always have a great team. Have you run into some organizations that have been really great but are missing one piece? Does Vertex or VC organizations like Vertex go in and try and help them realize their limitations? Or is that kind of one of the no-nos of VC?
I'd say historically, VCs hate to say why they say no, because I'll lump myself into this class, are always concerned about the opportunity to get another shot on goal, to have that founder come back and say, hey, I did this new thing and now I'm totally different, rather than turning off the founder by saying, we didn't like XYZ. We didn't like that you didn't have a business person on your team or a technical person on your team. There are a class of investors, and I'll put myself in this class as well, or ourselves in this class as well, that are like Vertex, that strive to give honest and actionable feedback to founders early. We are very careful with it. We try to be honest. We try to be positive. But you're absolutely right to hone in on the missing ingredient of a team. Is honestly, it's probably the number one reason that we end up not investing in a team or a company, is because we see something missing. And we do our darndest to tell the founder or founders why we think it's missing and why we think it's important. And then, they can decide whether or not they want to solve that or not, or heed our advice or not, or go to the knock on the next door to raise capital. We have made, I say that though, and I'll give you the opposite, which is we have made investments in solo founders, purely technical founders who don't have a business co-founder. And then we tell them in the investment process, like, here's the number one thing we want to go do. We want to go hire a business person, but we want to do it with you and make sure that they're bought into that on day zero, if you will. I was recently in New York this week and was sitting down with another investor at a very well-known blue chip firm. And, he said his comment to me was he mostly invests at Series A and beyond, which is kind of the $1 million to $2 million revenue mark and up. His comment to me was, if the team's not perfect, I'm not investing.
Wow. Okay. Let me go show my old federal hat. There's been many, many, many times I've been involved with conversations within the US federal government and DOD where they're saying, gee, I really wish technology X was available, but I don't have a mechanism within the Department of Defense to go and fund that. Have you actually heard of people saying, I wish technology X existed? Can you go out and see if it actually exists in your proposals that people are pitching you?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We've heard that from, I'm trying to think how to phrase it. But basically, there are venture capital arms of the U.S. government and of other friendly governments that invest in funds and invest directly in companies. And I think, you know, one of the goal, their major goals is to sponsor that type of innovation and research that maybe can't happen inside of the federal government. You know, we've seen a lot of things around communication technology, new types of materials, you know, new types of security, you know, both attack prevention and things to thwart, attacks come with sponsorship by some of the government affiliated venture capital arms. In our case, we spend, I'd say, more of our time, just given that we've worked for so long in enterprise and worked in big organizations, we spend time with the CIOs and CISOs and heads of technology or engineering of, you know, in financial services and high growth internet companies, et cetera. And that's part of our sort of theme building and community building at Vertex is we're trying to constantly learn and understand sort of where are the gaps and problems. One, so we can connect people, just because that's building good karma. If I can help you solve a problem, you know, I'm hopefully, you know, earning credit and earning favor to come and ask you for help later down the road. And we use those interviews, those calls, that time spent to inform ourselves as to, you know, where we should be spending our time. And if you, and you know, to use the analogy of going truffle hunting to find the people that are working on the big ideas that relate back to what we hear from enterprise or some governments.
Well, Jonathan, you'll recall when we were talking before we went on air, we told you that 30 minutes would fly by, and darn if it hasn't. It seems like there's a lot we could still talk about. Unfortunately, we've hit the end of our time. Now, one of the things we try to do here on TWIET is give our guests a chance to tell us what they want us to know about their firm. Now, many times that's a product they want or a service they want to pitch. Things are a little different with Vertex, but what would you like us to know about Vertex that we haven't asked you about yet?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. I feel like I got to say it by weaving it into my answers, but I guess I would generally say that, you know, we're still bullish on tech. We're open for business. We're funding new founders and new startups in and around enterprise software and data infrastructure. And, you know, as a firm, as a boutique fund that's, you know, comprised of people who have been founders and operators, like, we like to work side by side with founders and, you know, think that that's a great way to build a great and enduring companies. And with that, I'll thank you again for having me on the pod.
Well, thank you for being our guest. As I said, we've wanted to have someone from a venture capital firm here as a guest, and you have been absolutely perfect. Everything we could have asked for. So, thank you so much. Would love to have you as a guest again at some point in the future.
Awesome! Thanks so much.
Thank you for being one of our viewers, whether live or in a recorded version. We really appreciate you being here. Before I wrap things up, want to go over and ask my co-host and friend Brian Chi what he has planned for the coming week, what he's working on that's keeping him busy.
Well, you know, I like to tinker. In fact, you know, I think that should be my new nickname, Tinker. Anyway, I love to also hear your suggestions. It was interesting enough, I didn't think venture capital was something that our viewership wanted to see until I started getting hit by emails and Twitter messages. So, you know, why don't you throw some ideas at me? On Twitter, I am ADVNETLAB. That's Advanced Net Lab. You get to see some of the things. I actually went and played hooky for a little while and went to go and see a warbird museum in Titusville, Florida. That's actually some pictures of a very rare double Mustang, P-51 Mustang. Two Mustangs grafted together. There's only six of them left in the world. got to see one in person. Very cool. I also would love to get emails from you. People ask me questions. People make suggestions. Sometimes people complain at me. That's fine too. You know, it's also fine if English isn't your first language. You know, feel free to use a translator. I'll use a translator back. Just keep in mind that one or both of us are using translators. Not always perfect, but I will try. My Japanese is okay. My Spanish is a little better. My German is just a little bit. But I will try to answer your questions as best as possible. I am Chebert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T at twit.tv. You're also welcome to throw email at twit@twit.tv. And that'll hit all the hosts. PR folks, send it to Chebert@twit.tv. That way I can shuffle things going and try to not lose your email. I'm getting upwards of 300 or 400 a day, so it takes a little bit to sort through, so please be patient. And we'd love to hear from you. So VC is one of the threads that people have been requesting, along with things like cloud computing, hybrid computing, zero trust, obviously. Lots and lots of ideas coming at us, and we will try to book guests that will fulfill your every wish. So, want to hear from you? See you next week.
Thanks, Brian. And obviously, as you heard him talking, Brian is not only my co-host here, but the producer of the show, going out, finding our guests, making sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's crossed to make sure we can bring you people like our guests today. Now, if you want to follow me, please do so on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA. My writing for most people appears on Dark Reading. That's darkreading.com/Omdia, O-M-D-I-A. Got a piece coming out this coming week. Would love to get your opinion on that. Also, feel free, of course, to follow me on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn as Curtis_Franklin. Would love to hear from you. Always appreciate hearing from members of the Twiet Riot. Well, that's it for us this week. We'll be back again next week, bringing you more news from the world of the enterprise. Remember, if you want to know all there is to know about enterprise technology, just keep Twiet.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, but your game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. But you already knew all that. What you may not know is that Twit now has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.